great to be with you. Positive psychology. Some of you will have heard of it. There's a big craze happening around Australia. I think that it's reached epidemic proportions. Positive education. Schools are signing up for PosEd and wellbeing all over the place. As I was preparing for the comments that I'm going to make with you today, I had a chat with my eldest daughter. My wife and I have six daughters. And everybody thinks that's so funny. We have a dog that's a boy. Actually, he's not quite the boy he once was. But that's a bit of a sensitive topic. We won't go there. I was talking to my eldest daughter. She's in grade 10 at the moment. And I said, I'm talking about positive psychology. I'm talking about depression. I'm talking about youth and those sorts of issues. I said, can you just tell me a bit about your friends? And let's go through the list. And let's have a look at how many of them are psychologically healthy. How many of them are doing just great? And she said, that's tough. I said, all right, well, let's do it a bit systematically. Let's write out all of your friends' names. We wrote out a list of 20 or 25 names. We didn't get onto Facebook. It would have been 487,000 friends, but strangers are friends on Facebook. And so we went through this list of her 25 besties. And I said, just cross them off if they've had to go and see a psychologist or a well-being officer, if they've got stress or anxiety or depression, if there's any self-harm, if they're having major relationship issues or anything that's causing significant enough psychological distress in their lives that it's impacting on their capacity to function in a healthy way. Maybe they're missing days of school, maybe their relationships are in turmoil, maybe they can't get out of bed, maybe they're self-harming or they've got eating disorders. And as we went through the list, we'd talk about each child for maybe a few seconds, and then she'd say, actually, I've got to cross them off because that one's cutting her hips with sharp objects. This one's swallowing dishwashing liquid. Or this one's hasn't been out of bed for 3 weeks. I said, these are your friends. She said, oh, no, they're really nice people. And I'm sure that they are, but they're damaged and they're struggling and they have terrible psychologically challenging circumstances in which they're working. Once we'd gone through the list of about 25, my daughter and one of her friends were the only two names that did not have a line through them. And that seems to be probably at the upper end, but seems to be fairly consistent with what I experience when I go to schools and I talk to students and I talk to teachers and I talk to social workers and wellbeing officers about mental health and wellbeing among our young people. The World Health Organization is indicating that by about 2020, depression will be the greatest global suck on our not just on our community, but on our global community. It will have the greatest cost of any disease, the greatest disease burden of any disease, depression, by 2020. We're well on the way. Currently, it's sitting in number two position. And by 2020, of course, it's our youth who will be adults, and they will be adding to that burden, and things will be terribly challenging for them. It's a fairly depressing statistic. Along with that, 2 months ago, in May, headlines around Australia and newspapers said this, from teachers, we don't have time for mental health. We're too busy. Well, I hate to say it, but the kids don't walk into your classrooms. They don't walk into your offices if you're not a school teacher. I know that many of you here today are not teachers, and leave their baggage at the door. They don't sit back there and say, it's okay, I'm here to learn now, I'm ready to go. The challenges remain, the challenges persist. What I want to share with you today are some new tools, not so that you have to make more time, because you are busy, you've got a lot going on, but some new tools that should not be adding to an already overflowing toolkit. Instead, there's some tools that will be useful for you to swap out some of the less effective, less useful tools and put these new ones in, try practicing them, and see if we can do something about improving the well-being of our young people. Let me start off by telling you a little bit about what positive psychology is. Traditionally, psychologists have said, what's your problem? Let me see if I can help you. You've got depression, that's fine. You're working at -5, no problem. Let's move you to 0. But as you would know, just because you're not depressed, it doesn't mean that you're healthy, mentally healthy. In the same way that if you woke up this morning without a migraine, well, that doesn't mean that you're physically on fire. And so about 15, 16, maybe 17 years ago now, Professor Martin Seligman, who many of you may have heard of, he's the father of the modern positive psychology movement, he said, we've got to do something about this. We know a lot about what's wrong with people and how to get rid of those problems, but we don't seem to know enough about what's right with people. How can we help people to go from zero to plus 10? How can we help people to wake up and say, you know what, life is good? And even when things are bad, life is still good. I have things that I can be grateful for. I have things that I'm looking forward to. I have a contribution that I can make to the world. And even when things are tough, I can bounce back. I can be resilient. And so positive psychology in its modern form was born in its present iteration. Let me walk you through what positive psychology looks like. In the same way that when we talk about psychopathology, we're talking about this great big umbrella term that includes all of the psychologically distressing issues that might happen to a person. Positive psychology is a similar great big umbrella. It's just that instead of at the negative end, it's at the positive end. I'm going to share with you a model of positive psychology that Seligman developed. I need to emphasize before I even begin that this model has very limited empirical support. However, it has great theoretical underpinnings, and for our discussion today with the limited time that we have, it's a nice little launch pad to give you just the general gist. I wouldn't recommend that this would be the model that you would use if you were to try to implement well-being strategies in your school. But positive psychology looks at five aspects according to Seligman's model. The first is a P for positive emotion. We know that when people are feeling lots of what we call positive emotions and only a little bit of what we would call negative emotions, that they tend to flourish, they thrive, they feel good. Now, this is not always true. Positive emotions are not always healthy. For example, when you're at a funeral of somebody that you love, a positive emotion is grief. But when you're sitting here, I hope none of you are grieving yet. I've still got 20 minutes to see how we go. Positive emotions, though, are typically the ones that make us feel good. But even negative emotions have their place. Positive emotion is a contextual idea, and we need to remember that. The next is E for engagement. If you have worked with young people for more than 3 minutes, you will know the difference between an engaged adolescent and a disengaged adolescent. And you will know as well that the one who is disengaged is certainly going to be at far greater risk of having challenges in their lives than the ones who are engaged. Engagement leads to a flourishing, happy, well life. In the central column there, we have an R for relationships. There may be nothing more important as a singular contributor to our well-being than the quality of our relationships. And any of you who work in any kind of a psychological capacity would know that the majority, not all, but certainly in the majority of challenges that our young people face, particularly when they're dealing with issues around depression and stress and anxiety and eating disorders, and the list keeps on going, you can almost always take it back to a relationship struggle somewhere. Not always, but almost always. It may be a relationship problem with parents or siblings or somebody in the schoolyard or just a friend from out of school, but relationships are central. Other people matter to our well-being and happiness, and if we can get relationships right, we tend to see that drug and alcohol abuse and all of the things that we've talked about and that you'll hear about today, they really do reduce in substantial ways. The M stands for meaning in life. This is an interesting one that goes back to the whole positive emotion things, because some of the people who live the most meaningful lives of all do not have very many positive emotions. People who are working as humanitarian aid workers in war-torn, disease-stricken countries are probably not walking through their Ebola-ravaged camp and thinking, gee, life's good. I'm feeling really positive about things right now. But if you ask them how meaningful their life is, they will say it is incredibly meaningful. In fact, many of you working in service industries, it's probably not always fun and beer and Skittles when you're dealing with some of the challenges that you face. But what you do is meaningful. You make a contribution. You help. And when you sit down at the end of the day or at the end of the week or in the upcoming school holidays, you think, you know, what I am doing, it matters. And it's meaningful. And we feel good. We feel happy. We feel pleasant because of that. And the A, this one's questionable, but in Seligman's model, he says that we need to have achievement, we need to have accomplishment so that we can feel happy and live a well life. Ultimately, if we were to pull it all together, we would say that positive psychology is about positive emotions, engagement, the development of virtuous personal characteristics like wisdom and temperance and honesty and gratitude. The different paths to fulfillment and meaning in life and a quest for satisfaction and purpose. What I'm going to do with the remaining time is share with you just three of a list this big, just three positive psychology strategies that you can implement, hopefully starting today or tomorrow, in your work with young people, not only to make their lives better, but even to make your life better. These strategies do have empirical support. They do suggest, or the support that the data does suggest, that when we practice these things, that it can be useful in alleviating psychological distress and anxiety and depression and many of the other challenges that you'll be facing when you're working with children, particularly those who are struggling and those who are disengaged. So let's get started with the first one, strengths. This is what, I'm so sorry to do this to you. This is what the academic literature tells us strengths are. Strengths are highly contextual phenomena that emerge in distinctive patterns alongside particular goals, interests, values, and situational factors. Do you get that? I've read that definition in public and in private several hundred times, and I'm still not quite sure what those authors who are world experts in strengths were trying to say. However, there's more than one author and there's more than one paper about strengths. And what we can glean from the psychological literature is that strengths have four characteristics. They're pre-existing. You know, when you give some kids a ball, or you put some children in front of a maths problem, or you put a child in front of a musical instrument or ask them to sing, or you give them a leadership opportunity, they just get it. You know, it's just inside them. It's authentic. It's pre-existing. It's who they are in some ways. When they use their strengths, you'll also find that it's energizing for them. When we're using our strengths, we just feel great. Feel fantastic. We're doing what comes natural in some ways, and it makes us feel good, even more so when we're helping other people. And strengths are usually linked with optimal performance. When we're using our strengths, we do things well. We're competent. And we certainly, typically, will do them better than other people who do not have that strength, unless those people who do not have that strength have practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced and turned it into a strength. So if this is a strength, I like to think of it as inside all of us, we have potential for excellence. Some of us have lots of potentials for excellence in lots of areas. Some of us only might have one or two. But a strength is when we exploit that potential for excellence. And the way that we do that is we enhance our awareness of it, we give kids access to develop it, and then we get them to put in the effort so that they can develop that strength. So with that in mind, and with that as a backdrop of strengths, and because I know that you're an enlightened audience and you've had lots of professional learning development, probably talked about strengths a lot in various meetings and things, I'm going to ask you to turn to somebody beside you in pairs, and you've only got 30 seconds. I'd like you to describe your strengths to the person next to you, then I'll call out and I'll get you to swap 30 seconds later so they can share their strengths with you. Your time starts now. Five seconds to go. Okay, swap. Tell your partner your strengths now that you've listened to theirs. Five seconds to go. Time is nearly up. Okay, thanks everybody. I'll get you to wrap up that conversation. Now I stood here and I watched very closely until I got about halfway back and then I needed my glasses to see any further. And what I noticed was that for most of you, as soon as you started talking about your strengths, something happened. The energy in the room changed and it changed fast. You were smiling, you were engaged, you were leaning forward. You were giving all of those signs that this was positive and good and it felt nice to talk about your strengths. Now, there were some of you, though, who just looked at the person next to you and said, I don't know. And it was interesting to watch those of you who were doing that, because you were usually sitting there with your arms folded and you were sitting back in your chair and you had this puzzled look on your face and you did not look energized and you did not look competent or authentic at all. It was hard. The research tells us, unfortunately, that about 2/3 of people cannot identify what their strengths are. If you were to get a clipboard and a pad and a pen and wander down the main street of Perth today and stop people randomly in the mall and say to them, what are your strengths? Not only would they look at you strangely, because why would you do that anyway, but they would not know in 2/3 of cases. They wouldn't be able to identify them. I was in a little rural town in New South Wales last week, a little spot called Dunedoo. And while I was there, I asked a group of 7th and 8th grade children what their strengths were, and I had one 13-year-old girl say, I don't know, no one's ever asked me that question before. We don't even have the language for strengths in many cases. We don't even know how to define a strength or give an example of a strength. And all too often, that happens. Now, if strengths are so important for well-being, and they are linked to high levels of well-being, when we use our strengths, we feel good. What does that tell us about all of these kids who are coming to school every day and don't know what their strengths are and don't have any opportunities to use their strengths? If you feel strong when you're using your strengths, how do you feel when you're not using your strengths? Not strong, usually. Not competent, not energized. And quite often you'll sit there and think, what am I doing here? So my first idea, and it's kind of an obvious one, for what we can do to help our young people to identify and develop their strengths is to practice strength spotting. Now, that requires two things. Number one, it means that we've got to have some sort of a language of strengths. And there is no official language. There's a few different strength spotters out there, strengths finders on the internet. I'll tell you about one in a moment. But you know what? You can just walk up to somebody and say, you are a dynamo, you're an energizer, you're a leader, you're a this, you're a... It doesn't really matter, so long as it's positive and it's tapping into their strengths. I have a 5-year-old who is my energizer bunny. That's just who she is. That's her strength. She's just got energy. Another one who's just so positive all the time. She's my positivity person. But when we spot strengths, please don't point it out in front of everybody. I can't just say, Ramesh is in charge here today, as you've probably noticed, or Andrew. I ask them to stand up and say, you know, I've been watching you for a while, I've known you for a little while now, and in front of everybody, I just want to point out these are your strengths. How excited will they be to hear that? I think they say, well, gee, thanks. Would you like to put it on a chart and put it on the wall for everyone to look at as they walk past? It doesn't help. People have always said praise in public and criticize in private. The research would tend to suggest that we give good feedback in private as well. It seems to have a much better impact on people. They respond much more kindly. They appreciate it as much more sincere. Practice spotting strengths and then look for ways that our young people can use those strengths. Be creative about it. Give them opportunities to use their strengths. Help them to feel competent. Help them to feel strong and energized and do what comes natural to them. Now, if you don't have much of a vocabulary around it, you might try the viame.org website, where there is a free strengths finder. I want to, again, give a little caveat. This is not the best strengths finder on the market, but it's free, and so it's a good place to start. Empirically, it's just not quite right, but it's good enough, and it will get you started. And, you know, you could do it in a pastoral care class, or you could do it with a client. Just get them to... Everyone loves filling in questionnaires about themselves. I get to find out whether I'm a rooster or a dog or a lion or a B or a D or a IJKP thing. So we love filling those things out, and kids love filling them out about themselves as well. Learn the language of strengths. Unfortunately, research tells us that about 1 in 5 people, just under 1 in 5 people, 17% of people, are using their strengths every day. That means that more than 80% of people are not using their strengths every day, which means that more than 80% of us are not feeling strong. And if we're not feeling strong, we're feeling weak, and we're unfortunately already giving ourselves access to depressive, hopeless, helpless kinds of ideas and feelings. So if we use our strengths, that's key number one for today, we can boost our well-being, and if we can get youth to use their strengths, we can help to boost theirs as well. Let's move on to the next one. We're going to talk about gratitude. Imagine that you were in 3 columns and not 2, if you can, for me. I need to walk away from the microphone. I've been told not to leave the microphone because we're filming, but I need to move for this little activity. Is the microphone still? Oh, excellent, this one's working great, terrific. Imagine I've divided you into three groups. Group one, group two, and group three. Now, you don't know that there are two other groups. You think you're it. And because psychologists love to do this. We mess with people's minds when we're researchers a little bit. And so I say to group one, for the next 10 weeks, every Sunday afternoon, I want you to sit down for 15 minutes, and I just want you to write down everything that, excuse my language, everything that sucked during the week, everything that was just absolutely horrible, make a list. 15 minutes every Sunday afternoon. Can you do that? Does that make sense? Okay, they're going, why do I have to do that? That sucks already. Okay. Group two. What I want you to do every Sunday afternoon for about 15 minutes is make a list of everything you got up to during the week, kind of like a diary. Doesn't matter if it's good or bad, just what you got up to. Make sense? You're so vocal today. Make sense? Yeah, all right, fantastic. Feeling better when we make some noise, yeah? Okay, and group three. What I want you to do is I want you to, every Sunday afternoon for about 15 minutes, make a list of all the stuff that was awesome, everything you're grateful for during the week. Make sense? Yeah, see how excited they were about that? Now, if we did that for anywhere between 2 and 10 weeks, depending on which experiment we're talking about, I'm going to share with you some findings that are a summary of about a little over a dozen studies that have done something like this. Okay, this is not one study, this is a conglomeration of a bunch of them. At the start of the 10-week period, you're all the same. If we look at the average of group one, group two, and group three, same average age, same balance of male and female, same average income, same average number of visits to the doctor, same average amount of alcohol consumed, same average health, same average levels of depression and anxiety and all that sort of stuff. You're all pretty much the same on any measure that we look at because you're nice large groups. At the end of 10 weeks, something remarkable happens to the gratitude group relative to the other two groups. Compared to these two groups, this group over here on my right who have written about what they're grateful for 15 minutes, once a week, for a handful of weeks, find that they are more energetic at the end of 10 weeks. They're more optimistic and they have better social connections. Now think back to what I mentioned in the R in relationships for, you know, PERMA. Relationships are the central predictor of our well-being. Grateful people have better relationships and they have more relationships and they have deeper relationships. So therefore, this group is also happier. This group has less depression. They have less alcoholism. They have less greed and envy. They have more income at the end of 10 weeks than the other two groups had. These guys are going, I'm knocking on the principal's door in 10 weeks. I'm doing this. I'm going to talk to my boss, my manager. I don't care who it is. Money won't make you happy, okay? The research tells us money doesn't make you happy. No one ever believes me when I say that. Better sleep, more exercise, healthier, less materialistic, better grades and work outcomes, less health issues, happier with friends, happier with family, and happier at work. Just by doing a simple gratitude exercise. I think that's pretty cool. Now, this works with kids as well. Jeffrey Froh, probably the world's leading expert in gratitude and adolescence, has done some studies. Let me share this one with you from 2010. He found that grateful teens, this is just a correlational study, grateful teens more likely to be involved in and absorbed in activities than their less grateful and more materialistic peers. People who are grateful just get involved in life more. They get more absorbed in tasks. In a study with 1,035 teens, gratitude was linked with academic outcomes. More gratitude means better grades. Better social integration and higher life satisfaction. They also had lower envy and less depression. And in the one that I love, because it's following the same model that I just stepped you through before with the three groups, Jeff Froh again got 221 sixth graders. They're just 11 or 12 years old, and he got them to talk about, you know, for a couple of weeks what was a hassle, what was just par for the course, and what I was grateful for. And he found that relative to those two groups, the gratitude group in a study of 221 sixth graders, looking at school only, their approach to school only as a dependent variable, the gratitude group were more satisfied with school. They were glad to be there. They enjoyed it. They were interested. They wanted to learn. And the researchers found that this was good at the 3-week follow-up. When they walked back into the school and did the study again 3 weeks later, that finding had persisted. Gratitude has a powerful impact on well-being. It's a way of inoculating our youth against depression. Now, of course, if you sit down with somebody who's dealing with depression and you say, well, you know what, I heard Justin speak at Generation Next, and he said that if you can just think of something that you're grateful for, you'll be happy. You know what any teenager's going to say to you, don't you? Got nothing to be grateful for. That's stupid. Because they've got depression. It's very hard to do that. However, there are some things that we can do that can help. Here are some ideas. Number one, be grateful. Model it. Be a happy person. Be a grateful person yourself. Number two, say thank you. Kerry Howells from the University of Tasmania has written the book Gratitude and Education. And she talks about how powerful it can be when people who are working with young people just say thanks. They say it and they mean it. They say it sincerely. They express appreciation. They walk into the classroom and they say, I just want to let you know that I really appreciate how respectful you were while I was out of the classroom speaking to that person. Or they walk into their office and they sit down in front of that teenager who's having a hard time and they say, I just want to let you know how grateful I am that you came in today. I know you've been having a hard time and it would have been easier to stay home. Thank you for coming. It's not hard to say it, but how often do we do it? Now, I've also written be grateful not just for the positives, but also for the negatives. A friend of mine, Paul Burns, he's an assistant principal at a school in New South Wales, had a parent come to him one day who let him know precisely what she thought. Anyone have car park mafia parents like that in Perth, or is that a New South Wales only thing? And she gave him a real dressing down. She served it up. And she told him everything that he was doing wrong with her daughter and why he was not a good enough teacher and why the daughter deserved better and why this was not right. Now, imagine you're in that situation. What's your typical reaction? You might get a bit defensive. You might try to explain to the teacher to the parent why you did what you did and maybe even gently let them know why they're wrong. Not to put too fine a point on it, but Paul did something different. He practiced gratitude. He looked at this mother once she had finished and he said, I just appreciate so much that you came up to the school to tell me that. Now, what do you think that she said then? He said a couple of other things that showed great humility and showed what a great person he is. He said, not only do I appreciate it, but I really am so thankful that I know how important your daughter's education is to you. That makes a big difference to me. He said, we can work together because I know that. And he said, I want to just say thank you as well for pointing out some of the areas in which I can improve as a teacher. I know that I'm not perfect and your comments will help me to be better. Now, I think that's powerful. Can you imagine what that mum went home and said to her daughter that night at the table? Well, that Mr. Burns. Yeah, I like him a lot. What a teacher. And can you imagine what she said the next day in the car park to all the mums who were there whinging and complaining about the teachers? And she said, well, you know what? I had an amazing experience yesterday with Mr. Burns. It can change Mr. Burns. That sounds very Simpsons, doesn't it? Just realized. We can invite grateful reflection. If we're dealing with somebody who is depressed, we can just invite them when they're able, maybe next Sunday afternoon while you've got some quiet time, why don't you sit down and do that list? It can be useful as a therapeutic intervention. And we can have a grateful things box. We might put it in the classroom and people can talk about what they're grateful for. We could put it in our staff room or in our office so our colleagues and co-workers can do it. And then at the next staff meeting, whoever's running the meeting pulls out two or three of those grateful things that have been dropped in there anonymously, and we change the culture of our environment because people are grateful. I think there's some powerful ideas there. Powerful booster to inoculate us against depression. Let's look at the next one. Andrew Fuller, can I ask you to please come up here and spend some time with me? I've asked Andrew to do something with me. He does not know what is going to happen. He's just volunteered. I volunteered him. Andrew, are you an optimistic person?
Yes, I think so.
Andrew, okay. What I'm going to get you to do, this has been cleared, by the way, with the New South Wales Department of Education in terms of risk assessment. I do need to mention that it has not worked twice. No. Are you still feeling optimistic?
No.
No. What? Okay. Sorry, I lost my train of thought because I'm a little bit nervous as well now. I'm starting to shake. What I want you to do is balance this on your hand like that, okay? And don't let it fall. If it falls, please don't try to catch it because I'm going to set it on fire. Jeez, I hope this... Where are the fire alarms? Okay, all right.
Hang on.
All right. Sometimes this can take a moment. Sometimes it can take a few moments. No, look, we need to just sort of puff it out a bit at the top there. Okay, let's try that. Can you just flatten your hand? I'll let you do it because you're going to feel it better than me. Just talk quietly amongst yourselves while we... He's nervous. He's not feeling as optimistic as he was. He's shaking. We might need to get another volunteer. Oh, well, look, I could put it on the book, but then it's not going to be nearly as exciting. Because we want it to... Thank you for the offer. Ah, no. All right, Andrew, we're going to give you one more time, and then I'm going to look for a volunteer who's optimistic in case you can't get it. No, I need another volunteer. Somebody that's got a nice flat hand. I need somebody. Thank you. Come on up. Oh, no, sorry. No, that's fine. You come up. That's fine. We'll dance as well. What's your name?
Jean-Paul.
That is very French. Let's see. I'll let you do it again because you can feel what's going on better. See if you can balance it. I've never had a really, really flat palm. No, it's on an angle. It's as steep as the Pyrenees. Okay, here we go. You ready? Jean-Paul? I don't want you to move at all. Just let it burn. Are you an optimistic person, Jean-Paul?
Totally.
That sounds optimistic. Gee, that's getting low, isn't it? Whoa, whoa. Jean-Paul, thank you. Whew. Could you feel the heat, Jean-Paul, as it was burning down towards your hand? I get nervous when that's happening sometimes. I did have it not work a couple of weeks ago, and this poor maths teacher, it singed his hand. I had to smack his hand, and I get worried now and then. An optimist is somebody who believes good things are going to happen. Jean-Paul was jumping at the opportunity for me to nearly burn him. That's an optimistic person. Isn't that great? Now, you think about it. Somebody who's depressed, how optimistic are they about getting up tomorrow and heading into school or going off to work? They're not. But optimistic people are happy people. There's something more important than optimism, though, and we've already heard Gallup mentioned this morning. Gallup are looking at hope. And what hope does is it says that optimism is good, but we need more than optimism. We need to have goals. We need to have pathways to achieve those goals, and we need to have efficacy or agency. It's a belief that we actually can walk along those pathways to those goals. People who have these three things in their lives do better. It's that simple. Now, I'd love to talk to you a whole lot about this. Unfortunately, time is going to beat us. So let me just talk about a couple of things that we can do. Number one, sometimes to build hope, an adolescent just needs to have someone standing beside them saying, I believe that you can do this. I'm here with you. I'll support you. I know you can. Sometimes they just need to have something to look forward to. So we could say to them, guess what? Later on this week, we're going to do something really awesome. Now, if you're a Year 9 maths teacher and CERDS is coming up, that's probably not going to be exciting. Guess what, kids? After lunch today, we're going to learn about CERDS. Oh, goody. That might not work. But if we can find things that they can look forward to, then that can be powerful. One of my favorite things to do with my kids when I put them to bed each night is I ask them what they were grateful for today and what they're looking forward to tomorrow. I want my kids to wake up the next day looking forward to something because they'll get out of bed. They'll feel good about life. Teach them the power of the word yet. Y-E-T. I can't do it. Can't do it. It's too hard. Well, you can't do it yet. Maybe we can say to them, well, what can you do? My mum used to say to me when I said, Mum, I can't do it. It's too hard. I can't. Mum would say, can't means don't want to. And she was right. We can do just about whatever we want. In fact, that reminds me of a poem. Commonwealth, I won't say the name of the bank. Just a bank had a marketing campaign recently. 1 minute. Okay, I'm going to go really fast. Bank had a marketing campaign recently, and they had a poem called Ode to Can. There's a four-letter word as offensive as any. It holds back the few, puts a stop to the many. You can't climb that mountain. You can't cross that sea. You can't become anything you want to be. He can't hit a century. They can't find a cure. She can't think about leaving or searching for more. Because can't is a word with a habit of stopping the ebb and the flow of ideas. It keeps dropping itself where we know in our hearts it's not needed and saying, don't go, when we could have succeeded. But those four little letters that end with a T can be changed in an instant when shortened to three. We can take off the tee. We can do it today. We can move forward, not back. We can find our own way. We can build, we can run, we can follow the sun, we can push, we can pull, we can say, I'm someone who refuses to believe that life can't be better with the removal of one insignificant letter.
How awesome is that?
If we build hope in our young people, we can help them so much. Now, I was sent a whole bunch of questions to answer. We're not going to have time to get into them, but I'm going to mention a couple of things really quickly because I do want to help with that, and Andrew will just come up here and push me away from the microphone when time is up. I'll be very quick. Question number one. Do primary and secondary schools have a responsibility to help develop positive self-esteem in young people? Yes. You cannot have a neutral impact. You're in this because you want to make life better, so do it. Boost their self-esteem. Remember that those who deserve it the least, by the way, are those who need it the most. They need you to be that positive impact. They need you to help them feel good about themselves. Number two, how can we assist young people to come out of the cave of their bedrooms when they may spend all night playing games and then sleep all day? And I can read further through that, but really, I think what we've talked about today can be useful here. If they have something to look forward to, if they're optimistic, if they're hopeful and have goals that they're working towards, and a belief that not only have they identified their goals, but they have pathways to follow, then that will incentivize them. If we can help them to use their strengths, they need to feel stronger outside the bedroom than they feel inside the bedroom. And if we can help them build meaningful relationships outside the bedroom, we all want good relationships in the bedroom, but that's a story for another day. Help them to know that other people outside the bedroom matter. Next one. One of the issues we find challenging is getting students who are obviously distressed and sometimes angry to accept help from school counselors. I give two talks other than this one. Normally I do 3 hours on this in your organization. But I give two other talks that could be useful to answer this. And because I don't have enough time to answer it properly, let me just talk about one of my talks is about autonomy support and removing control. The other one of my talks is about emotional intelligence. Both of those things, I believe, will be the best answers to that challenge. The next one, how can I as a school chaplain help children find self-worth if their parents have destroyed it since early childhood? Last year, Andrew Fuller published a book called Tricky Teens. He also ran a study with 16,000 Australian youth. And he found that of those 16,000 Australian youth, I think it was 8%, were highly resilient, only 8%. But he found that the most highly resilient children, the ones who had the highest levels of self-worth, said yes to two particular questionnaire items that the kids with the lowest self-worth did not say yes to. I have a parent who listens to me. I have a parent who cares about me. These young people need to have adults in their lives who listen and who care. And that is how we do it. We could keep on going. I wish I could answer them all. Unfortunately, I can't. I'd like to leave you with this. These are my details. If you would like to talk to me about the presentations that I offer in other organisations, in schools, in Commonwealth Bank, American Express, wherever, please come and have a chat with me downstairs. And by the way, for everyone who gives me their business card and says, yes, I would like some more information about your talks, I'll put you in the draw to win these three books. One of them is called Mindset by Carol Dweck. The other one, the all-time best positive psychology book, The Happiness Hypothesis by Jonathan Haidt. And my book from Acer Press, What Your Child Needs From You. Thank you, everyone. I've really enjoyed talking to you.